Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Bottom Line with Jessica English. How is everybody today? Well, I'm doing great. I'm here in Minnesota, and I just barely made it back in time to do my show. I was out at the movie theater this afternoon watching Prometheus, so I don't know if you guys have had a chance to check it out, but 3D is pretty cool nowadays. That was my first 3D I've seen, and it was really a lot of fun, and I hope we have a lot of fun today on the show. I think Ridley Scott has one heck of an imagination, and I think I have a pretty decent imagination, too. I hope you do as well. I think we're going to get a little creative today. We're going to talk about some really interesting questions, talk about some different ideas and solutions. I don't know if you have plugged into the coffee party because you are into overturning Citizens United, or if you've come to our movement because you are into the environment, or social justice, or you're anti-war, or maybe you just stumbled onto the show on Blog Talk Radio today. But whatever brought you here today to the show, I invite you to stay for the fun, because, yes, we are going to have a bit of play today. This morning I also went to my weekly meeting of inspiration. Some people call it church. And it was a lot of fun. I was really inspired by the message today that really focused on play and how important that is in our lives. I know we're right getting into the really good parts of summer. My kids just got out of school, and many of you are gearing up for boating and skiing and sitting on a blanket on the lakeside or at the beach. And so I hope you got that in this weekend, and I'm glad you're tuned in for a couple of hours of really really great discussion. So, yes, let's begin. You know, I think it was interesting watching the movie today because, you know, the whole theme of the movie was about scientists trying to find the answer to why we're here and how we got here. And, you know, I often wonder why the heck I'm here and who hasn't thought about it. I mean, so many Hollywood movies are about it. But, you know, we rarely talk about it with each other, right? And maybe, you know, it's not a question that pops into my head on a daily basis when I'm running around doing my ordinary life. Usually I think of this question when I'm freaking out or when I'm really kind of in a low spot, like, what am I doing here? And you know, I had one of those times recently. I was coming out of the food shelf, and it was a long wait that day, and I was just a bit frustrated, and I had to hurry really fast to get to the school to pick up my kids. And right outside the door was this guy with this really nice car, and he comes up to me, and he was a pimp. And, you know, he's talking to me, oh, you must have fallen on hard times and blah, blah, blah. And I was just like, really, really, is this what I need today, universe, you know? I'm already at the food shelf. I'm already working my butt off and, you know, making minimum wage. Do I really need this today? And I just kind of blew him off and got in my car, went and picked up my kids. But I bring it up today because, you know, I want to get a discussion going. I mean, I want to ask these questions that are so rarely talked about because we're too busy talking about the latest distraction out of the 1% media. But, you know, what are we doing here? I mean, is this really the kind of society that we want to live in where we take women who are parents, who are working, and men, you know, and making a minimum wage and, you know, subject them to, you know, begging for food. And then while you're begging for food, you're getting hit up by somebody who wants to, you know, get you into the sex trade. Is that really what we want for our kids? Is this what we want for our families, for our elderly people, for our teachers, and for ourselves. So anyway, those are some questions that I'm throwing out there for you. You know, I just want to tell you guys from just the bottom of my heart, that day was just so frustrating. And when you're in that kind of situation, it's hard to imagine that there's other people out there who could even begin to understand what that feels like. You know, I can get into those isolated moments where I feel like I'm all alone. But you know what? I bet there's people listening out there today who've had situations that were like that or worse, or, you know, on the same line. So if you're one of those people and you think about these things too, please stay with us. If you like to have fun and just, you know, get together with friends and have an interesting debate, please stay with us and call in and add your point of view and tell me about your situation. You know, I want to believe that our minds aren't so steeped in cynicism and convention and selfishness that we can't imagine or create solutions to our problems. And so if you're like me and you want to just fight back against that cynicism that seems to be out there, that apathy, please join the discussion. The number to call is 646-929-2495. And I want to introduce my guest. I'm really excited to have him on the show. His name is Ken Pentel, and he's a fellow Minnesotan. And he has run for governor a few times with the Green Party here in Minnesota, as well as the last time in 2010, he ran with the Ecology Democracy Party, a party that he helped to found. So he has a lot of experience in thinking about solutions and gathering people together and getting to work. I think that's why I'm so inspired by him. He doesn't just sit back and let that cynicism and conventional ideas and selfishness and, you know, or just the demands of our daily lives creep in on him very much. So, Ken Pentel, thank you so much for joining us. Are you there?
I'm glad to be here. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you great. Am I coming in all right?
Yes, very good, very good.
Excellent.
Good to be on the show, Jessica.
Well, thanks for joining us. A friend of mine, I have to give a shout-out to him because he actually had a meeting with you and just mentioned the show, and he said, man, he sounds like he'd be interested in doing your show. So I was pretty pumped about that. So thanks for being open to doing the show.
You got it.
So, yeah,
right.
Well, this week, now, before we get into our big discussion, I'll let the phone lines light up. I already have people calling in. I just want to remind you guys, if you want to join the discussion, you have to press 1 so that you get entered into the queue, and I will call you out by your area code. So my area code here in St. Paul is 651. So if you're calling in, listen for your area code, and I'll give you a heads up before I go to you. Again, the number is 646-929-2495, and our guest today is Ken Pentel. And, you know, last week on the show, we talked about National Coffee Party Week. We were just kicking it off last week, and there were different events held all across the country because we're getting back to our roots a bit and starting to gather again in the coffee houses like we did at the very beginning of Coffee Party back in 2010. So anyway, like I promised, I thought I would fill you guys in on how that went. So I know that, Ken, you were planning on coming and you weren't able to because you also had another event going on at the same time.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah, I know, but it was really fun. You know, it was the first event that I've held like that before, and so I didn't know what to expect, really.
What did you guys do?
Well, you know, I did a one-hour training with Billy Sears. He's one of the guys on the Coffee Party board who actually trained us in on and gave us some ideas for holding such an event. And he also trained us in on the website so we could create the event on the Coffee Party website. And then the Coffee Party was able to send out invitations to all the people in the database and email people to let them know. And so I just followed Billy's instructions, and they sent out email invites both a week before the event and then a couple days before. And we all got together at Coffee Grounds on Hamlin Avenue, and it was really fun. It was really great. I didn't know how many people would show up because I, you know, just threw a bunch of emails out there and called friends and stuff. But I invited people to come and do an open mic, kind of like we did in Washington, D.C. for this a coffee party event called Citizens Intervention.
Okay.
And we opened up the mic so people could send out a message, their message for their legislators or for their government or just to the people in general. And so we had like a mic and we had coffee and we just put our chairs in a circle and we had an intro and 14 people came out, and I'm really glad to say that everybody was really motivated. It was a very motivated group of people. And everybody was, the overwhelming message I got was that everybody was tired of getting together and just talking. They really wanted to do something. And so we've agreed to start a chapter and meet each month, and they were really passionate about educating citizens on what's going on, as well as taking some action. So we're actually getting together on Wednesday when the St. Paul City Council hears the proposal to overturn Citizens United. There is a proposal in St. Paul that's coming before the City Council. So we're going to go in support of that.
What time is that?
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, find that out.
I think it's at 7. I might be wrong. If you're listening and you're in St. Paul and you know the answer to that, please call in. And I'll look for it in my notes while we're talking today. So it was really fun. And it was really nice to get out behind my computer and actually get together face-to-face and talk to people and find out about the issues that are really affecting their lives that they're really passionate about. And, man, we had such a diverse group. There was a teacher, an unemployed reporter, an immigrant who's now a business owner, and a former legislator or councilman who also produces a TV show now, another Blog Talk Radio host, people who were really into the environmental movement, and people who were at the civil rights movement. So it was really neat. It was really amazing.
Good deal.
It was really, it felt like a warm up for today.
Good. Well, you know, it takes that kind of energy to, you know, develop a sense of empowerment among people. Because a lot of people, like you say, some people are isolated. And they feel alone. And until they're in a group with others who are common-minded, they won't feel that sense of kind of what I call collective courage or that collective energy that's necessary for transformation, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. You know, that's interesting when you talk about the transformation because it seems like a lot of us, in our heart of hearts, really want to see transformation in this country. And who doesn't like transformation? I mean, look at HGTV. I mean, is it really that fun watching people pick out paint colors and looking at paint chips? I mean, that's not that great. But I tune into those shows sometimes just because I want to see the before and the after. You know, I want to see the big reveal. So I think that kind of idea of transformation is really... it's empowering in itself.
Well, and I think, there was Wangari Maathai. I don't know if you're familiar with her. She helped found the Green Belt Movement in Kenya. She's passed away since. But she basically started out as a movement where she was working with rural women in Kenya, and they started to plant trees to restore forests that had been decimated. And she said the women started to believe in her efforts and so on as soon as they started to see the trees actually growing. and becoming a very real, tangible part of their lives, you know, fixing soil, providing local wood, you know, more local groundwater, and empowerment for women was a big part of it. And so those outcomes are important. I mean, people do need to see, you know, that the work they're doing is sprouting outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have to be huge, but it has to be an indicator that we're moving towards a direction, you know, moving somewhere. And that, to me, is a big part of this effort that you're working on and many others are working on.
Yes, definitely. I think that's the frustration, too, for people who are part of the Occupy movement or who've been watching the Occupy movement. You know, it has very little, I mean, it started with anarchists, and it has very little hierarchical structure, right?
Mm-hmm.
And people say, well, what is the point of it, you know? And I kind of wonder, how do you measure anything if you don't have that overarching message that you're sending out, or if you're not asking for demands, or if you're not, you know, if you don't have an agenda, that is communicated, how do you know when it's starting to work? I mean, I've been impressed with just their ability to sort of change the national narrative, to get young people and older people together, because a lot of times when I go to the events, there's people there of all ages, but but I do think that is a bit of a frustration that I have with the movement. Is just what's the end goal? When can I see that we're getting somewhere?
See, and that's a big part of what I've been working on for years, and I've been trying to convey, at least recently. You know, it's always frustrating with me. I mean, I've been involved in a lot of different movements, and needless to say, I'm so grateful for them. I mean, Greenpeace for 11 years, Green Party for 12 years, vital efforts on this planet. And the people that have been involved in building them and mobilizing have had tangible successes. With Greenpeace, I mean, in the early 70s, Greenpeace took a little boat and floated it near or towards the detonation of atomic weapons in the oceans of our planet. That symbolism really started people to rethink testing nuclear weapons, at least at that time, above ground. And because, you know, Greenpeace's efforts and others as well, but Greenpeace really shined the light on it, atmospheric nuclear weapons testing was stopped during the Reagan administration and the Gorbachev administration. So what we're looking at, and the French stopped, and it was a global agreement. You know, same thing with whaling. I mean, you know, Greenpeace went out, a little boat between a whale and a whaler, and a harpoon went over the head of the Greenpeacer, and that picture went around the world, and it launched Save the Whales. And 11 years later, there was a global ban on commercial whaling. At that time, but eventually the commercial interest on the planet caught up to Greenpeace's tactics, and they basically, after a while, neutralized them. It was just, you know, once again, tangible outcome in that situation. You know, my discussion, and we can maybe go into it deeper, is, you know, how do you take stirring of energy among the human condition, which has been what I've been meditating on the last 4 years, how do you take that energy to heal, to solve problems, you know, find balance in the world we live in, and how do you take that energy and translate it to liberal power, what I call translating it through power. So there's a regenerative healing energy that's at the point of decision-making on these issues. And that, to me, is the test right now on Earth, is we're stirring a lot of energy at the grassroots, and there has been some successes, it really is not dealing with the Exxon Mobils and the Bank of Americas yet. We're still not dealing with these interests that are pulling levers of power on the planet and doing massive damage and creating incredible inequity, not only extremes among the ecological condition, but among the social condition. So to me, that's the test, you know.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And that's the challenge, right? Because in a lot of ways, those bankers and those polluters and those powers really have a lot of money. And now that, you know, they've opened up the floodgates to the campaigns, it's an interesting situation that we're in when it comes to our democracy and how powerful our voices can be in the face of that. I just want to give people a little bit of background about you, if that's okay.
Sure.
So you grew up in Minneapolis, right? And you graduated from Hopkins. And do you mind my asking how old you are?
I'm 51. I graduated in 79. Yeah.
Okay. And so then, so you graduate from school, and your parents, I mean, did you grow up middle class or...
Generally, middle, it depends on what side of the family. My parents separated when I was five. My father had money. My mother struggled. And we lived with my mother. When we visit my father, it was pretty upscale. With my mother, it was lower middle class.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow.
That's bad. And I grew up suburban, generally grew up in the suburbs. That was pretty much it. Yeah.
Okay. So then you grow up and you graduate high school, and then can you tell the listeners where your path went from there?
Well, leaving high school, I initially went to college, about 2.5 months of college. I was going to go into theater, failed my first theater midterm, and said, forget the college thing, I'll just go straight out to Hollywood. So I jumped in the car with my mother. My mother was going to move out to California and spend time with my sister. And we're driving into California, Southern California, across the valley, and the sky, the clouds are not normal. And I looked at my mother, these are not normal clouds. And she says, I know, that's smog. And I said, what? You know, it's like, you got to be kidding. I mean, the sky was filled with these gray clouds, and it was like, you got to be kidding me. I mean, the sun looked like the moon when it peeked through, and the people, everybody's walking around like it's a normal day. And I'm like, something's wrong here. So my dreams of Hollywood started to dim at that very moment, basically, I think. I started to get a little nervous, and things were creeping me out a bit. And, you know, that evening, they tell the children and the elderly, you can't go off the next day because the air is too polluted to breathe. And I'm like, why aren't people just furious about this? Why aren't they, you know, going after these sources of pollution, you know? But you know, there was a small handful basically doing it, but other than that, it was just normal. You know, people were just normalized to it. And so eventually, you know, I just started to lose my edge towards, you know, this idea of show business. And 6 months later, I'm down at Venice Beach, and I found out why they closed beaches, because the night before there had been a storm in Santa Monica Bay had basically regurgitated its floor onto the shore. And so I had an idea of seeing what gets dumped in the Gulf, or basically in Santa Monica Bay, and it was absolutely disgusting. And I found out why there's about 2,500 beach closings a year in the United States. But this one was absolutely disgusting. And so now I'm starting to get angry. My sister's going, Ken, this anger is not helping us around the house here. And I'm like, but I can't believe what we're doing to the planet. So then I get word they're going to build nuclear power plants on fault lines. I'm like, I'm ignorant. I don't have a physics degree. I don't know nothing. But I know that it just doesn't make sense to me to build a nuclear power plant on a fault line. And this was, I think, Diablo Canyon or San Onofre at the time. So I go to my first Nuclear Regulatory Commission hearing, and I'm standing there with a, you know, large group of people who are testifying and passionate about, you know, trying to find other ways to provide, you know, basically boil water. And I'm like, you know, here's these sophisticated people with the NRC and scientists and people representing the corporations who want to sell us these nukes. And they're all very smart and telling us to calm down. Everything is safe, you know. Don't overreact. And so I just started to get really troubled by this whole situation overall. And I went to a No Nukes concert following that hearing. And I walked into Hollywood Bowl, and there was like 20,000 people outside, 20,000 people inside. And then I said, oh, I'm not alone. And I felt kind of a catharsis about many booths, talking to many people. There was many organizations. Greenpeace was the one that kind of sparked my interest initially. And I felt empowered. You know, it was like 85 degrees that day. There were fires going on all around the Hollywood Bowl. It was performers like Bonnie Raitt and, you know, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and, you know, Bruce Springsteen are performing. I'm like, wow. You know, like I was
wow.
a kid. You know, I'm like 19 years old, and I'm like, oh, man, this is awesome. You know, and now from that point forward, I started losing my interest in all this fame and fortune stuff. And I started to really get angry and upset about, you know, and disturbed. I traveled the country, Florida, my family in Florida and California. Eventually in 86, I opened the paper, Greenpeace is hiring. And it basically, I've been in a vacuum ever since. So that's kind of how it all got going.
Wow. That's really, it's such a great story because, I mean, for one thing, I think it speaks to your grit that you get in a car, drive out to Hollywood after
yeah.
failing. You know, because a lot of times somebody fails something and like, oh, I remember in seventh grade I thought it'd be cool to be a marine biologist, and then I failed, you know, biology, and mostly because I just didn't want to cut up things that were dead animals. But and that's when I knew being marine biologist probably wasn't, you know, in the right fit for me. But you know, it's really fascinating that you're just like, all right, that's it, I'm just gonna go for it, you know. And
yeah.
I can just looking at what you've done, you know, you just really have a lot of grit to just keep going. So I think
yeah,
that's really cool.
That's
the other
true.
Cool thing too is that a high school kid, like you say, it doesn't take, you know, doctorates or something to understand the danger that we're
exactly.
in.
Exactly.
It really doesn't. My little kids can look at, you know, things and just come up with the most profound questions. And, mm-hmm. you know, my daughter, she's 5 years old. She's my youngest. Her name is Willow. And and she's just a ball of energy, you know, and she's been going to this really beautiful preschool. They've been so fantastic to us. They've treated us like family, and
mm-hmm.
which has been great because it's been a tough year. And you know, it's always hard for kids to move and go to a new community and be in a new school. But she just loves going there. And on her birthday week, she got to make a poster about herself. And so she could share with the class, you know, family picture and that kind of thing. And one of the questions was, what do you want to be when you grow up? And she just, like, very firmly, you know, without any hesitation, she said, I want to be a mommy, you know.
I love it. Well, definitely you've been a good role model then.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I don't know. But I just, the first words that came to my lips were, well, no, you can't be a mommy. That's not a job. And then I caught myself and I'm like, wait a minute. I'm starting to, you know, give her these ideas that tick me off so much. This idea
well,
that all this work women do is not a job, you know. So
right,
I was
right.
like, all right, we're putting down mommy, you know. And then
exactly.
she also said she wanted to be a unicorn.
Well, you know, what can you say? I mean, you may be able to get one, not the other. But the important thing is that what you bring up is very valuable. It's mommies who hold communities together on this planet. I mean, there's really no other way around it, especially if you're looking at, you know, places that are people that are not of wealth. You know, people in Africa and Asia and South America, a lot of the work in this world, about 75% of the world's work is done by women right now.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it is in the household. You know, a woman in Kenya wakes up early, you know, go get water and schlep the water and haul it back and tend to the animals and take care of the kids and, you know, on and on all day long until 9 o'clock at night. And then she does the same thing again 7 days a week. And the way the economic model on this planet is set up, her work doesn't show up on a balance sheet anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's not calculated. Well, obviously we know. I mean, the woman is doing the work that keeps the glue that keeps the community together, and that's the stuff that that's one of the things I decided I would focus on more after I left the Green Party in 2008 was to start being more accurate about what we consider valuable in our societies and how does that relate to economy, you know. I've known a lot about it, but I was basically living in America, you know, in the commercial bubble and techno bubble, commercialism erodes people's ideals towards this repairing of our relationship to community and the planet. And that's one of the things that changed for me in 2008. I wasn't going to compromise anymore on that.
Mm. So you were with Greenpeace for 11 years. How did you get involved with the Green Party?
Basically, it was Nader sparked my interest in 95. He was willing to step forward and be on the ballot in California as a Green. I had followed the Green Party since the breakthrough in Germany in 83. Green Party won 23 seats in the Bundestag using a proportional electoral system. I tracked them. I was inspired by the Greens, but I really had an attitude towards electoral politics, which was misguided, but it was an attitude. I think I thought direct action was it. And we can talk more about that, but I transitioned when Nader ran, stepped forward, a guy who I really admired. I considered him a man of integrity. I think he and I probably disagreed on some things, but overall, I just said, if he's stepping forward, I'm going to help work on his campaign. And he said, if you're willing to get me on the ballot in other states, go do it. And we did it here in Minnesota in 96. So that got me going into the Green Party. So I kind of overlapped. I left the Greenpeace effort and then transitioned into the Green Party in into 96.
Okay. So now you were in the Green Party. What kind of work were you doing with the Green Party? Were you running at that point?
I was all purpose. So I was kind of lead organizer for Nader 96, you know, field organizer. And so I did office work, door-to-door, help manage campaigns, you name it. Media, lobbying at the Capitol, with Greenpeace, a lot of direct action. We didn't do much direct action with the Green Party. And so basically it was just, just all-purpose organizing. That's what I did.
So how many years did you do that before you decided that you wanted to actually take the torch and run for office? It was
about 98. I mean, it was a very nonchalant discussion with a fellow organizer, and she looked at me and she said, listen, you know, why don't you run for governor? And I said, you know what? I'd spent enough time at the Capitol. I knew how the operation worked. I knew, you know, the whole basically situation, and I basically ran for governor because it's kind of something that suits you. You know, it's like people have certain things that are part of their character, and that was the only seat that interests me, and to this day was being governor, because I basically had a bioregional vision of how I wanted to plan for this region, and I saw Minnesota as a holistic region. Very interconnected at a variety of levels, but basically easily, in my opinion, becoming self-reliant in energy and food in a healthy way. And so that was kind of my vision. How do we make this a bioregion healthy? Not, you know, Minnesota as a state is kind of what I would consider artificial lines, basically set up for financial purposes. But my goal ultimately is moving towards a bioregionalism on this continent.
Mm-hmm. And what does that mean exactly? Bioregionalism, so we would have different regions based on the biology in that region?
Yeah, basically understanding the limits of the resource base and building economies that restore the resource base, don't deplete it. And so here in Minnesota, we've got rich resources. So we've got the Mississippi Basin, the Great Lakes Basin, and the upper the Hudson Bay Basin, basically the most fresh water probably in the world bubbling out of this region. So, and we had rich topsoil and diverse tree types and animals and so on. So we're really good. Places like Phoenix and Las Vegas, they really are draining a lot of resources. They don't have a lot. So bioregionally, their population would be very small. Phoenix would probably be dramatically less in population if it wants to live within the means of the resources available there.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to build community based upon what are the limits of the resource, how do we live our lives, have happy, full lives without depleting them. And so, you know, you've got in this continent, you know, at least North America, we've got the Cascadian region, Pacific Northwest. We've got here the Great Lakes region, the Upper Mississippi region. The Northwest, and then you've got the Southeast, Lower Mississippi, and the Southwest. And so those, to me, are generally how I'd look at bioregions at this point. I mean, others can probably slice and dice it differently, but in a short synopsis. And then you learn how to live within those regions. And if you can't, you don't build up huge populations and you don't create subsidies for farmers to overuse the Oglala Aquifer or the Colorado River and all that stuff we're draining rapidly right now, because in a bioregional planning system, it wouldn't be allowed. Those systems, you know, if you're going to plan, you make sure that the Oglala Aquifer is restored. It's not depleted. You make sure that the Colorado River is running in full force. You don't dry it up, you know. You know, you make sure topsoil in the Midwest doesn't go from 3 feet 50 years ago down to 6 inches, which we've done.
Right.
It wouldn't be allowed in a bioregional planning system. So that's the approach I'm taking towards, and that's basically the long vision, you know. The short vision, we can talk more about that, you know.
Sure. Well, I was thinking, wow, you're speaking, you know, you're talking about planning here. I mean, since when do politicians plan for, you know, beyond 2 years in the next election?
Right,
you know?
Right.
But it sounds like the kind of thinking that, you know, maybe if we did take a long approach, you know, we could fix some of the problems that we're dealing with climate change, with pollution, and with our energy needs and our reliance on potassium in order to grow all of, you know, feed that soil that we've completely depleted. Potassium is a very finite source. It comes, a lot of it we get from, Africa, I think, you know, which, again, puts our country at risk because we're relying on these outside sources. And, you know, and then we have all the oil it takes to drive all those tractors and everything, you know, and we all know where that comes from. So I do have a caller calling in that has a question for you.
Please
at 908.
Uh-huh.
So I'm just giving them a heads up that I'm going to come to them in a second. but I do want to ask you a tough question. I promised my listeners I'd ask you the tough questions because you're somebody who I've actually listened to in debates answer them and not just speak from a stump speech like we're used to, which is extremely refreshing when I've, you know, heard you in debates. And so I'm wondering, you know, with your Green Party experience and everything, how did you feel after the 2000 election with everything that went down with George W. Bush winning and Al Gore, you know, and folks looking back on that election and saying, well, you know, if we hadn't had the third party, Bush wouldn't have gotten in.
Oh, well, to me that, I mean, I don't know, to me there's like 1,000 variables one could have looked at, and seemingly the people that were upset about Ralph Nader running looked at only one variable. But neither here nor, I mean, I don't know, I didn't really sweat that. I mean, obviously George Bush was, he's basically, the way I see it, the candidates who are running are generally front people. They're allowed to run. But George Bush was a little, you know, low grade. Basically his dad made a few phone calls and made sure that his son got elected. Al Gore, these are bad people. I don't know them personally. But, you know, Al Gore as a politician, I really didn't like him a lot because he always was duplicitous on a variety of levels. If it's, you know, claiming he wants jobs, but then he supports NAFTA, GATT, WTO, corporate global trade. If he's, you know, supporting militarism and he wants to protect the earth, these to me are contradictions that can't be resolved. To me it's one or the other. So Al Gore was not the answer for me in any way, shape, or form. He was counter to the objectives in many respects. And of course, Ralph Nader, myself, the Green Party, didn't make the decision in the Supreme Court, which is horrendous. You know, it's a mockery of, you know, judicial precedent. It's a mockery of justice. That I thought it was a government of we the people, and everybody seemingly was willing to comply with the Supreme Court saying, stop the counting, and, you know, we won't get an accurate count of how people voted at Florida. So I don't know. I mean, many variables involved. Kathleen Harris and Jeb Bush scrubbed the voter rolls, you know, of tens of thousands of people, on and on we can go. Any one of the third-party candidates one has to decide, was Al Gore out to earn his votes, or was it supposed to be just handed to him? People have to ask that question. But neither here nor there, every third party who ran got enough votes that seemingly could have swung that election. But that wasn't the point. The point is that we have, in many respects, a prepackaged, pre-purchased economic and political system. Whether George Bush runs or Al Gore runs is irrelevant. It's a systemic dysfunction that we're having to deal with. And so for me, it really has very little to do with, Ralph Nader or Al Gore or George Bush. I do believe, you know, Ralph Nader would have done a better job than the other two. So I supported him. And I'm inspired. I was inspired by him. And so it got me off the couch to go organize. And isn't the aspiration of democracy to inspire people, to give them a reason to participate in their governance? So that's basically, and if it wasn't Ralph Nader, so let it be Ross Perot, or let it be Socialist Party, or let it be, you know, a grassroots party candidate. I'm not complaining. I'm inspired when people say, let's engage. I want my point of view represented on the ballot line. You know, it's when people who are disingenuous about that upset me. And that's where it comes down to many groups I agree with at the grassroots who stir energy up, and then they send their energy into a political party who is counter to their objective. You know, so I worked with Labor in the early 90s to stop the North American Free Trade Agreement. 110 groups in the Fair Trade Coalition here in Minnesota. Awesome effort, I thought. You know, we did a lot of research. We had some politicians on our side, whatever. 80 groups out of the 100. What's that?
I said, really? I didn't realize this. Okay.
Yeah, so, yeah, it was 110 groups in this Fair Trade Coalition. 80 of them are like Labor. They're huffing and puffing. I agree with Labor in the workplace. You know, I believe in economic democracy and so on and so forth. But, so Labor, huff and puff, made a lot of noise. Bill Clinton shoved the North American Free Trade Agreement down the throat against his own base, the people that supported him. And then the next cycle, Labor goes and endorses Bill Clinton.
Right, that's what I was kind of surprised.
You know, and then they endorse global free trader Al Gore, and they endorse global free trader John Kerry, and global free trader Barack Obama. You know, it's like, I don't get it. I mean, where is the Labor Party? I mean, at least you got to, if you're going to stir energy at the grassroots and you want an honest reflection of your values, then at least offer energy from the grassroots to positions of, you know, decision making, and offer people a choice on the ballot line. But instead, they endorse interests that are counter. And so you can look at, and in Minnesota, just to give you an idea, back in the 30s, there was a third party here called the Farmer Labor Party. And they were generally the number one or number two party, however people want to look at it. But they had leverage because they could run candidates and get votes. As soon as the Farmer Labor Party joined the Democratic Party in 1945, ever since then, it's been a slippery slope for farmers and laborers, ever since. And so that's why I feel very strongly that if you're going to stir energy up at the grassroots, then at least offer an honest reflection of your values on the ballot line. You know, the eco movement I was involved with for many years, and there's very many passionate people, and we've gotten a few crumbs along the way, somewhat success stories, one would call them. But basically, they end up endorsing interests that support a growth model on a finite resource base. Well, you want to save a planet? I mean, at least offer an honest reflection of what you desire on the ballot line instead of endorsing interests that are counter to that objective.
Definitely.
So,
well, I told 908 I'd get to them, so I'm going to bring 908 into the discussion to find out who this is and where you're calling from. Hello?
Hi, this is Chad calling from New Jersey.
Hey, how's it going today?
It's hot. It's very hot.
Same here.
Yes. I actually sort of forgot what I was going to ask you about, but I'm really loving the conversation and everything that Ken has to say. I would say I'm a kindred spirit in that regard in many, many respects. I think that the thing that's irritating me mostly is that the truth doesn't seem to be relevant anymore about anything.
Right.
And even though, like, when you were talking about resources and things like that, I'm sure you're aware of someone like James Howard Kunstler or Small is Beautiful, E.F. Schumacher, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, resources, the problem, I think, is that we are where we are, and we become, as a lot of critics have said, we become so addicted to the lifestyle that we've been experiencing that, you know, it's sort of not in my backyard, and, you know, don't touch my Medicare and things like that. And we don't seem to have any empathy, even for our country, let alone other people. My frustration is that, you know, we just are where we are. And I think what you're doing in Minnesota is terrific. And I think that I should be doing the same thing here in New Jersey, and just sort of ignore the national thing, because I think that the national exposure, the fact that we're watching, I mean, I sit here in New Jersey, I'm 75 miles or 60 miles from New York City. And the main news is the Wall Street. Now, I don't have any investments. I don't buy stocks or anything like that. Most people I know don't have any stocks. And yet, that seems to be the most important thing we have to listen to in the news. And that's not mm-hmm. what the regular people do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But everything is targeted toward national news, getting us all psyched up. And we begin to realize we really don't have any effect on the national thing. We can't affect it. The Coffee Party talks about our own currency is the vote. And that's true, but it's only, you know, once a year. It's not an active to the, you know, we don't have any civic responsibility anymore. We don't even teach civics anymore. So,
mm-hmm.
and I have to confess myself, I have no idea how my state runs. And that's my
mm-hmm.
fault. But it's also
mm-hmm.
the education's fault. But the powers that be, because Lawrence Lessig, the money and everything, that's everything, that's in everything, is basically keeping us sort of off balance. So that
mm-hmm.
we don't really know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And we need leaders like yourself and stuff like that to get into smaller groups and talk to people straight ahead, not from above, not down, and start straight ahead and start to explain, you know, think about how your life is. What do you want your life to be? And not what do you want the life of America to be, because it's not working for us. It's the powers that be are, without a doubt, the powers that be, you know, and they control
mm-hmm.
everything. So, anyway, I really don't have anything else to say. I'm just sitting here in my workshop trying to make a bed, and I will continue to listen.
Well, good to hear from you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, Chad,
Jessica, mute me because I've got a machine's running, and I'll be a distraction to the conversation, okay?
I will mute you.
If I have something else to say, I'll press one.
All right, sounds good. You'll have to press one twice. I was just going to let you know, press one twice if you'd like to join us again. I've muted you now so you can go back to making beds. Shad is just an amazing caller. He's been on the show several times. He's also involved with our 99% media too, and he's also a furniture maker. And when he was talking, one idea that popped into my head when we talk about resources, you know, a lot of times when we think about resources, I think we think about the natural resources or those things that we can use to manipulate into a wealth stream. And that leaves out a lot of resources that has to do with community and compassion and and those other things that human beings need, minus all of the crap that we can go buy at Malwart, you know. We have a lot of needs beyond just feeding ourselves and clothing ourselves and getting shelter, and one of those needs is having, you know, something meaningful to do with our lives. You know, I know there's a lot of people who find meaning in their work, and I know Shad is one of them. He makes fantastic, beautiful furniture and fixes people's furniture that's sentimental to them, I'm sure. But you know, I stock shelves for a big corporation who, you know, uses me for cheap labor so they can make money for their shareholders. And how many cashiers are out there? I don't think that's probably the number one thing that feeds their soul, you know what I'm saying? And so I think the thought that I had is when we talk about resources, is thinking about some of those resources that speak to that part of the human condition.
Well, I think what we're talking, okay, so if I can paint a picture for you real quick about one of my objectives in the network, we have three mandates. One is we want structural change in the economy. The other is we want structural change in the way we vote. And third, we want structural change in who influences our government. And the issues you're talking about pertain to the human capacity and meaningful work are, to me, interconnected with the non-human world, our fellow creatures and habitats and so on. And so in an ecology-based economy, what we would do is we would put new measurements in the economic model. So when our water, air, soil, and habitats are healthier, economy itself is healthier, and vice versa. We would change how we measure these things by using things like, instead of the gross domestic product, which is one of the measurements that's used in the economy, people hear that all the time, the gross domestic product doesn't show value, it just shows activity. So, you know, when there's major spill, like the, you know, Prince William Sound, 11 million gallons get spilled, a lot of insurance companies need to be called in, and lawyers, and, you know, all sorts of activities going on, it creates economic energy around that, and it improves the GDP. It doesn't show value for the health of the fellow creatures in the waters. It doesn't show value associated with the people that have been wiped out who were sustaining, living subsistently off of that healthy ecosystem before the spill. It doesn't show any of that. So what we're trying to do is put into the economy what I would call whole cost accounting or life cycle cost accounting for our dependencies. So when water is polluted, the economy's we add that cost into the bottom line of the economy. People right now get their electric bills, and they only see the price of electricity. They don't see the cost of emphysema and asthma and bronchitis and cancer and death, you know, and so on and so forth. So once you start adding in the whole cost of things, then you start seeing a shift. A number of cross currents start happening in the economy. And what you start seeing is that certain industries cannot pay for themselves, like uranium and coal and oil, and energy dollars start coming back to communities, and we start hiring 2 to 10 times more people naturally in the economy to retrofit homes and buildings to become efficient renewable energy power stations on site. This now, an energy dollar that normally would have left the community or stayed in the community 2 or 3 times for coal or uranium, now that energy dollar comes back and it recycles 7, 8, 9, 10 times in that community. Now we have the ability to not only hire more people, but also localize the economy. And when people need housing, healthcare, education, and so on, now there's pools of wealth available that normally are flight of capital. Now they're staying in the community. And eventually, over time, what you do is instead of relying on the existing energy system, which is about 70% waste. Electrical transmission is about 70% waste in the United States in transmission. Germany, it's they've only got about 10% waste. We have 70% waste. So instead of paying and working all these hours that people do to pay for wasteful energy transmission, now the overall cost of living starts coming down. And people, instead of having to work to pay for wasted energy, now they have time in their lives for their family, their friends, their social time, creative time, civic time, things like that, instead of basically being just producer consumers, which is what became a very prominent link to democracy after World War II. And we can talk more about how that happened. But basically, there was a strong emotional and commercial link between consumption and democracy. And we were told the more we consume, the better the democracy. This is highly dysfunctional thinking. And it leads to, it can literally physically lead to stressing out your ecosystems and inherently stressing out all subsystems within that ecosystem, including us, humans. So we need to have an honest discussion about how do we literally, physically change the economic systems so we don't continue to use up a limited resource base. And the benefits are that we not only stabilize ecosystems, but we stabilize our families, our communities, our social conditions.
That's awesome. I have to tell you, while you were answering, my line did drop for a moment, so I missed a little bit of what you were saying, but I agree.
Right.
I mean, I can't tell you how many days I've come home, and, you know, you talked about the woman in Kenya. Well, just to give you a picture, as a single mom, I have three kids who live with me Monday through Friday, and then oftentimes my eldest comes home on the weekends, and so, you know, I wake up, bring the kids to school, go to work, I pick them up. I get done with work at 3. It's a physically demanding job. I walk miles and miles on concrete. I don't get the black squishy thing like the cashiers do. And I'm constantly ripping cardboard, driving, you know, as a result, I ended up putting 2-inch holes in my shoes, you know. I was burning rubber, guys. So, but anyway, you know, I'm also wearing out my body. I've started dropping things last few months. I've got numbness in my thumb, you know, and just issues with my wrists. And you know, I tried to go bowling for my daughter's end of the year bowling field trip. I could hardly bowl anymore. But you know, and so I get done with work at 3. I go pick up the kids. I come home. There's only me here. I make supper. We do the homework. We do the playground. We, you know, have baths, and I read to them for an hour, and then we sing, and then I go to bed, and then I stay up for 3 hours writing because I'm also a writer. And when Target isn't enough, you know, I'm trying to pick up cleaning jobs, and so I'll go clean homes, which is pretty physically intense too. And just to be really honest with you, there are just days, and I don't know if you know a lot of women, but I know a lot of women, and we talk to each other, and women are cyclical. You know, you have 2 weeks of astounding energy. You don't need even 7 hours of sleep sometimes, you know, and then you have 2 weeks where you get a little tired, you know.
Oh, my God, I can imagine.
Our society does not measure for that. It doesn't even, we're not even allowed to talk about it. In fact, it kind of makes, you know, gives us a bad name, you know, and people make fun of it or whatever, or they, you know, women have been criticized for being emotional or whatever it is, but it's a monthly cycle that our bodies have because we procreate, you know? And it's nothing that's really going to change tone around 50. So, you know, but yet if I have a job, those people, when I show up, want me to be the same and have the same level of production every day. Well, sometimes it has nothing to do with the fact that I'm a woman. Sometimes my kids come home and they're puking all over the place and I can't send them to school. But you know, I got put on probation for having to have sick days, which I do not get paid for. You know, so it just seems like you get punished every time you turn around and you're a human being, and you get tired.
My heart goes out to you. I cannot say. I mean, I just feel pain. I mean, for one, my mother was raised 3 kids, single parent. My girlfriend, she's raising a child on her own. But the point is that there should not be that much stress in your life in the richest nation in human history, for one. And two, from my point of view, if we want strength, if we want health, if we want endurance, then I believe in holism, where you basically invest in those that are stressed out the most, who are hurting the most in society. So you take from those that have the most, you give it to those that are hurting the most, and you restore balance in your society so there's not as much stress. And you're working very hard to hold your family together, and you need some sort of relief for the benefit of not only yourself and your children, but for the society as a whole.
Mm-hmm. And yet I live in a society who would pay a daycare provider twice what I make to watch my kids because I qualify for that program mm-hmm. so that I can go make the minimum wage and be cheap labor for Target. But there's no kind of child stipends like in Europe. And I just wonder, how do I as a 33-year-old woman in this country compete with my ex-sister-in-law in Sweden? She had free health care. She had 2 years off. She got, as soon as her kids were two, then they qualified for school and the preschool program. So she always had free child care. She had a free education to become a preschool teacher. And her husband got 4 weeks off and he got paternity leave. And yet we're supposed to be the wealthiest nation in the world. I mean, I just wonder, how am I supposed to compete? But I know there's people who want to get in on the call. It looks like Chad had pressed one again. What do you guys think out there who are listening? I mean, there's other people who have called in to listen. Join our discussion. It'd be great to hear your thoughts on this idea, on this model Ken, you're so much better at saying it than me.
Ecology-based
really
economy.
Putting the price, the actual cost, not just a price tag, on our economy. So I'm going to go to Shad and see what he'd like to add here.
Yeah, always listening, to this thing. The thing I've wondered about for years. So I grew up in the 50s and in California, and even though my mother worked, and she only worked because she was in show business, and it's just different. But none of my classmates in public school, none of their moms worked. The fathers went to work. They had jobs. They had mortgages. They had cars. And, of course, maybe there was a time that the parents didn't talk to their kids about money and stuff like that. But we didn't seem to want for anything, really. I mean, we took vacations. We went to the beach. We had a pool. And it seemed like everybody was able to manage, and we had lots of free time, and the fathers would be out at the baseball diamond with us throwing pitches and snagging balls for us and stuff like that. And it was just an incredibly good time to grow up as a child. And
right.
And then somehow, and I think I did read something about this, but and not to say, women's equality or anything like that, but all of a sudden, I mean, it almost seemed like they – it took advantage of the fact that women wanted equality, and they sort of misinterpreted it and say, okay, ladies, we're going to put you to work. And it seemed like they lowered the standards and everything. So everybody works. Nobody has any time. We used to be able to just go drop in on somebody to have dinner. Let's have dinner together. We live in the neighborhood. Let's go dinner. Now you got to call somebody up and see if they're available a week from Friday to have dinner with you because everybody is so busy. And I'm thinking, what are we doing that we're so busy? And if, again, the wealthiest country in the world, I don't, the other thing that confuses me, too, is that it's thinking about capitalism. And then we have democracy on the one side and capitalism on the other side, but it's not really on the other side because they have nothing to do with each other, really. I mean, capitalism is a profit motive. And, here we've got Mitt Romney running for president, who's going to, run bank capital. And we're holding that up on a pedestal that making lots of money is the only motivation for doing anything. And I heard a talk show recently where someone said, called in and said, well, what's the problem with making money? Well, there's nothing really wrong with making money. But supposing these poor kids that are coming out of college now that have this enormous amount of debt, supposing you decide to go to college, a liberal arts thing, and you want to be an artist. You want to teach pottery. You want to be a social worker. Well, you go to the guidance counselor, and the guidance counselor tells you, it doesn't pay very well. So you have somebody whose heart is in something to do good for other people because it makes them feel good and it feels like a valuable job to them. And yet the society doesn't value it because we've been told that the only reason to do anything is to make money. And so I'm thinking, what do we tell the kids that are coming out with $60,000 in debt in the beginning and say, you know, go to Wall Street. Well, Wall Street can only hold so much. And, we have this huge problem of having put this capitalistic thing on high. And it's winner-take-all society that we live in. Even on lotteries, you know, you buy a lottery ticket. If there's 10 million people that buy a ticket, you'd think if you got four numbers right, you might get a couple hundred bucks. You get nothing. You know, you got to be the winner. And I don't know, this country is so addicted to this winner-take-all and this capitalism making money that we don't have time just to get to know each other.
Mm-hmm.
That's my comment. I'm going back to planning.
Good.
Awesome.
Well, excellent. Excellent. Jessica, should I step in on that?
Yes.
Okay.
Can you respond?
So, once again, nothing is absolute here, what I'm saying. And there's a lot of cross currents, and we're never going to be able to articulate what we need to do in the show. But I would say a couple things. One should look, I mean, human beings the last 100 years have been amazing on this planet. We've gone from 2 billion to 7 billion. We've gone from no TV to a cascading of technologies we can't even define, to nano, to genetic engineering, to whatever. I mean, it's phenomenal. No one can keep track. No one can even define what we're doing or find a language for it, basically. So we're amazing in our invention. And we've also increased our capacity for compassion and love and caring for each other. So I really believe in the goodness of human beings on Earth in general. But that growth, that amazing invention and everything has been at the expense of our host, Earth. And that is where we are weak and we are fragile in our relationships with the planet, because the weaker we make the host, all subsystems, including us, are weaker. And so we've seen massive declines in diversity of species and flora and fauna and so on. And so to me, that is what we need to focus on Earth. The human condition is, yes, there's unfortunate suffering and ruthlessness and criminal activity among the human condition that needs to be dealt with. I don't want to dismiss that. But as a whole, there is no greater attack and greater that's taken place than our attack against the non-human world. And part of it is tied to what the previous gentleman was talking about, because the economic system, which generally most nation states on Earth, the 193 nation states on Earth, all have to buy into a certain economic model, which is a growth model on a finite resource base. So what ends up happening is that he talked about people having women generally moving into the workplace. And there's nothing bad about that. But the thing is that the overextension of having to make more money is tied directly, in my opinion, to the overproduction that's tied to the growth economic model that we depend on. So the growth model rationalizes stuff we don't need. So, for example, in transportation, we built a transportation system for a horrendously wasteful technology, the automobile, that had built sprawl everywhere. We're putting a 150-pound person in a 3,000-pound vehicle, a vehicle that seats six. Okay. And for every 10 gallons we're putting in the tank, eight of it just is wasted as waste heat or discharge or whatever. It's not even used to power the vehicle. But for the companies that make this stuff, they make huge amounts of money in overproduction, and they get a lot of people working for overproduction. This applies to the food sector. You go to shopping malls, 70% of everything in those malls are overproduction. We don't need it. You know, there's certain industries in our society, in my opinion, that are drivers of this. One of them is, it started up about 100 years ago, is when they started to mesh. Edward Bernays is very famous for this, the nephew of Sigmund Freud. He took Sigmund Freud's psychological studies and meshed it with commercialism, and he's the father of modern-day public relations. And the goal, one of the specific goals of the banks when they hired Edward Bernays, was to have him shift away from the consciousness of the society in America, where basically people needed to know what the needs were, and they needed the facts associated with what we needed in our society. Edward Bernays shifted that to move it away from needs to wants, and shifted away from facts to emotions. So what we did is we started to tell people that it was okay to overproduce stuff. And what that did is then once you start overproducing, you know, stuff that you don't need in shopping malls and so on, which is what the banks wanted, they set up all these shopping malls around the country, and they help create sprawl. What you then do is, yeah, you have to get, if 70% of what you're producing is overproduction, then you do need people, two people working out of the household to pay for that overproduction, you know, for that excess sprawl, for that excess energy, that excess food. Yeah, because it's funneling, it's turning the earth into a commodity, funneling the raw materials into production, and then sending the financial benefits associated with that to a tiny group of people who've rigged the game to their advantage. And so, yeah, so then you see a lot of people overworking for overproduction. And what I'm saying in an ecology-based economy, the outcome of an ecology-based economy is that landfills and incinerators become obsolete. Nothing is garbage. Nothing is waste. For everything we build that's durable and repairable, for example, we save 10 times more in taxes each year for that product. And then that
it would be built into the system. It would be built into the systems that if you reused it, if you fixed it, then you would save in taxes.
It would be an inherent outcome, because if you build durability up front, you don't have to keep paying all that money out to extract raw materials to use a product once or twice, only to throw it away, to spend all that wealth again to go back in the natural world. If you build cities that are walkable or bicycle or train-friendly or bus-friendly, now you're talking about a huge amount of stress being relieved from people in their lives, because they don't have to deal with the stress of driving and paying for insurance and paying for the gas and paying for the military to slaughter people around the world to get the oil. You know, we don't have to pay for, you know, the carnage on the roads and the drunk drivers who, you know, you can have somebody drunk walking out of a bar. Either he can fall in a car and try to drive 60 miles an hour for 30 minutes home, or he can flop onto a bus or flop onto a train, and he doesn't have to drive. You know, and we don't even have to think about drunk drivers. But if you build risk into the system, which they do, then we have to pay for it. And if you, you know, it's like electricity. If you build risk into uranium dependency, we've dumped tens of thousands of years of nuclear waste on future generations that they have to work for and pay for. We partied, and they have to pay for our mess. I mean, it's so dysfunctional, not only just economically and socially and politically, but ethically and morally. It's sick, and we've been conditioned to normalize it, because a lot of this stuff is out of sight, out of mind, and it just infuriates me, this normalization of killing our host and stressing out our communities unnecessarily to make a few people uber rich. The mastery of it is a lot of it's tied to marketing, public relations, and advertising. People should not underestimate the sophistication of what I consider a fluff part of our economy. When I say fluff, it's a part of the economy that is absolutely not needed. Marketing, public relations, and advertising is fluff. There are probably some nice people, really smart people in these industries, but it's absolutely, these are people who spend their days manipulating human consciousness to desire wants over needs. And that, to me, is abhorrent to a decent society. And to me, it just is unacceptable. But it's part of it. It's part of the world we live in, and it needs to be analyzed. And we can just basically, if we wanted to, we could write it right out of the economy. But one should not, I mean, economies dominate. The existing global model of growth and GDP and what I would call interest on debt, we can talk more about it, dominates the globe. But in my opinion, political systems are precursors to economies. The convening of you and me and others, what we call governance, should decide an economy, not the other way around. But what we have is the other way around. Now we've got these uber-rich, pathetic billionaires dictating policy in what was, you know, what I would consider a good aspiration we're still striving for, which is representative democracy. To me, that's a positive thing. But we leave it to these people who are pathetic, and everybody stands by and watches and goes, well, we can't do nothing about that. Gulf of Mexico's got to be sacrificed, you know. This species got to go extinct, you know. You know, this groundwater's got to be contaminated, and I guess we just got to throw our hands up and leave it to Koch Industries to decide this stuff.
Yeah, and we have a ton of citizens who just throw their hands up and say, oh, you know, this is the only way it can be because I don't, you know, there's nothing I can do about it.
It is really sick, isn't it?
Yeah,
I mean, the normalization of this dysfunction to me is really a problem. And it's coming, you know, people in Fukushima know what we're talking about.
Right.
And they were probably 10 years ago, a whole lot of people who were just righteous about nuclear power are probably right now ready to fall on the sword.
And I do have a Facebook question here from Vicky, and I'm not exactly sure what part of the conversation she's referring to, but how does firing teachers, firefighters, and police fix the economy? This is her question. And I think she might be speaking to the issues that we're all experiencing in states with governments who are firing teachers and firing firefighters to fix their economies. She's wondering, how does firing teachers, firefighters, and police fix the economy?
Well, it doesn't. I mean, it has nothing to do with it, really. I mean, the economy is run by the people who print the money, basically. When you lose, you know, if we're going to maintain a public educational system and we claim that we care about our children and we claim that we want them to aspire to learn, not, you know, become producer consumers, but create an environment where they can learn, then of course cutting teachers weakens us. It doesn't strengthen us because we know that students learn best when there's, you know, 15 to 1, basically, you know, teacher to student ratio.
I've read some of the stuff that you've talked about, getting kids outside. And I really connected with that because my kids were lucky enough to be part of the first pilot program in America where this public school system partnered with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and businesses in Fergus Falls, and they built several classrooms out at the existing learning center that was part of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and they formed a partnership. And so the kids that are in fourth and fifth grade get to go out there, and they spend at least a half an hour outside every day. They get to work with the park rangers out there. My daughters got to tag butterflies. They got to tag ducks. They got to see the moon cycles for themselves, and you know, that's up in Zone 3. That's in way northern Minnesota, where it gets very much colder than here in the cities. And they were out there every day, and they did. There was a naturalist with the last name Seton, and they would do Seton watches every day, where they would just sit and be quiet outside. And my kids have never been more connected with life, you know, and more in tune with the creatures that you talked about that we're just slaughtering for this, you know, growth model that we have going. And one of the things that really struck me was how much time as human beings who've evolved over millions of years to be constantly with nature outside, touching leaves and the dirt that is filled with organisms and bacteria and you know, sitting in the grass or sitting in on a log and seeing all of the water and everything, all of those things that are so alive. I mean, you can't be outside without seeing movement constantly. But you go inside and everything that we touch, everything that we interact with, everything that we look at is dead. It's like we're living in our tombs, you know?
That's a very interesting point you bring up. And I do want to talk about governance a little bit at some point. But what I'd like to say about that is that I think you're absolutely right. And I think one of the, you know, obviously we live in a beautiful place. It's a beautiful planet. I love it. I do this because I love the place I live. The anger I feel is when I see what I love being dismembered and poisoned and disrespected and ignored. If you watch the information outlets since I've been born, since 61, the Earth doesn't exist. It just doesn't exist. Basically. I mean, you get some nature porn, but basically it just doesn't exist. Basically what you end up with is after-the-fact stuff. Oh, the Cuyahoga River's on fire. Oh, Fukushima melts down. Oh, you know, it's all after the fact, you know. Mm-hmm. The point is that this non-information, and remember, my generation, I was born in 61, so my generation, pretty much most all of my generation got all their information from television. And television is shaped by maybe 50 advertisers the last 50 years trying to sell us a lifestyle. No news outlets, no entertainment shows, you know, comedy, drama, you know, no sporting events. No one speaks against their advertiser, or you're never seen again on television or radio. So the commercialization of our information outlets is dysfunctional. It creates a distorted view of the world. So the idea of reconnecting young people to the earth is, I love it, but in a proportionate way, we're not even coming close to letting them understand the severity of not being connected to the earth. I mean, this is not a game. This is not an afterthought. I mean, this is about survival on the only host in the universe we can live on. And we have neutralized that relationship, purposefully or not purposefully. I don't know. I don't care. It's irrelevant. The point is that we need to understand that our physical existence on this planet is directly related to the health of the non-human world. And if we don't, it doesn't work the other way around. By restoring humans, you cannot restore the non-human world. You've got to restore the non-human world to restore humans. That is the way the path works. And people can try to rationalize that away, but it can't happen. And so the last 100 years, through our cascading invention, we've created a box environment. So we've got the box house with the air conditioning box, with the TV box, with the car box, with the cubicle box, with the computer box, with the iPhone box, you know, from one box to the next box. So you got the average child in the United States sitting in front of a box 7.5 hours a day. That's it.
Wow.
I mean, pretty much there. And the thing is that we're not. We're living longer than we did 150 years ago. Okay, I'll give to that. Water, sanitation, things like that have helped, elongate the life. We're at about 76, 78 years old per average, but we're shoving more and more into a limited life. So some people could spend their whole life just learning one piece of software, and consume their consciousness and their economy and their daily life just learning that software. Not related to water, air, soil, habitat, or microorganisms or diversity of species. That we don't have time for that. I've got to learn
the
software.
Well, there's hardly any jobs that pay to do that.
Well, they
can't
be an ecology-based economy. In an ecology-based economy, conservation biologists, people who heal the earth by growing food, heal the earth by tending to animals. Those healers on the planet, the people that restore forests and utilize selective logging as needed, those are the people, the healers of the earth, the indigenous consciousness, the peasant cultures on this planet. Those people would be honored and rewarded naturally in an ecology-based economy, and the pillagers and the plunderers would be marginalized, and if they continue to persist, they'd be jailed for their actions against the host, because it's a crime what's been going on in the last 100 years in relation to, especially the West, and their attack on our planet.
For those who tuned in with Tyson Slocum, who was explaining to us that when Enron was doing their rolling blackouts in California, and hospitals and educational facilities and apartment buildings for seniors were having the electricity cut, and, you know, the life force that so many people depend on to, you know, put the air conditioner on when it's 98 degrees so you don't pass out when you're 98 years old.
Right.
Right. None of those people can go to jail for turning off the electricity on those vulnerable people. But so they had to get them on accounting fraud. But that's the thing. There's no law against that. And so even though that it was just morally, none of us could even fathom doing that to our families or
right.
to somebody
and the thing
else's
is that,
family.
And
you know, but that was allowed.
Exactly. And it's part of the conditioning of low expectations in a commercially driven society. That's what we are. I mean, just talk about cancer, for example. I've had many family members die of cancer or get cancer. We've normalized cancer. The only focus on cancer is detection and cure. That's the message, detection and cure, detection and cure, detection and cure. You know, go out, get tested, commercially driven medical system, test detection and cure, you know, and then spend massive amounts on research to cure and get people to hike and bike for the cure and whatever. But seemingly we can't come to terms with Dow Chemical or DuPont or Monsanto or, you know, BASF. I mean, these are companies that are dumping cancer every day in the air and the water, indiscriminately. And we basically have decided, well, you know, that's okay. We know they're dumping and they're going to cause immune deficiency, birth defects, deformities, miscarriages, cancer, and death. But that's the price of doing business. It's called risk assessment.
They're job creators, Ken.
Exactly. God. And it's, so this is what angers me so much is the normalization of this dumping. Now, if you and I or somebody we know went in and shot 10 people with a gun, they'd either be fried in Texas or they'd live their life out of Minnesota in a jail cell. But if a CEO and a board of directors goes down to the state capitol and they wine and dine legislators and they spend money on the caucuses and the Democrat and Republican parties and they put nice, pretty advertising on television and radio, these guys, like you say, they're patted on the back. They make hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, and they're told they're job creators. And to me, that is no different than somebody taking a gun and shooting whole slews of people in the brain and saying, that's the price of doing business, and we bought the system. You know,
to me,
it's unacceptable. And we've been the only reason it happens, and if people claim they care about their family members who die of cancer, then they should be outraged because we know anywhere from 40% to 60% of cancers are directly related to industrialization. In our society. So it's not no one should say, how did this happen? Why did this happen? Go look. I mean, you know, whatever. But let's not even just talk about that. Let's talk about poisoning the planet and what it does to pollinators, what it does to our relatives, the whales, what it does to our fellow creatures all over the earth and affecting their health and their strength. Because if we weaken them, we weaken us.
Right.
There is no other way around it. So if people claim they want strength, they should act like it.
And it's sad that, you know, part of me when I hear you talk about those creatures, part of me cringes a little bit because I'm thinking, oh, what about the listeners who are going to be rolling their eyes right now because, oh, who cares about a whale? You know, but how sad that our culture doesn't put a value on those resources, and I'm not calling them resources because I want to go out and kill them to make some money or to eat them or whatever. I'm just saying the value that they inherently hold as a part of our symbiotic relationship with the planet that we live on. But even just saying, hey, let's consider what we're doing to those other creatures who I don't value as much for some reason as a human being, it sounds radical.
Yeah.
And I think that's just funny. My kids, I've seen my daughter the other day on the playground, my daughter Lily, who's 11, who got to go out to the Prairie Wetlands Learning Center and spend a year out there. The other day we're at the playground and she found a dragonfly that had broken its tail. And, you know, I told her flat out it probably wasn't going to make it, you know, but she sat with it, you know, and she found a little place for it and put it there, and she watched it die. And then she buried it, and she gave it a beautiful little, little grave with little dandelion fluff on the inside. And, you know, and so we're born with that kind of connection.
Exactly. And a modern day commercial and techno bubble cut that off. It cuts it off because we're told that the dominant way of living is to honor your, if basically winners live the lifestyle of the commercial vision by, you know, 50 or 100 advertisers. They're winners. The losers are those people that are self-reliant and they use dirty, durable stuff, and they get their hands in the dirt, and they hang out with animals, and they're not interested in, you know, making a lot of money. Those people are losers. The winners are those people who are always trying to turn the earth into another product. You know, those are winners. And we're, you know, and of course, nothing's absolute here. I'm sure there's very nice people who work at ExxonMobil who kiss their grandmothers and hug their kids and, you know, volunteer at the food shelf. Irrelevant. That's not the point. I mean, these people are going in every day at these multinationals, frothing at the mouth, and how they can extract more of planet Earth to make a product to sell in the short term. What we're talking about is long term. We're talking about how are we going to be strong long term. And we need to take this discussion of the ecology-based economy, and then we need to decide how does human intuition, because you and I have the instinct to heal our relationship to the host as a position of strength. Your children do. There's instinct there. How do we take that instinct and translate it through our governance? And right now, in the winner-take-all, single-member districts, we can't. We can't do it. It's a dominant two-party system. Both of them buy into the existing economic model. They both buy in generally to the existing form of governance. We're seeing some movement bubbling up around Citizens United and Move to Amend and so on around the country, which is fine. But generally, the dominant parties are going to absorb these movements, and you know they're going to appeal to them through focus groups or whatever. And basically, we're not going to be able to see transformation that we need to really resolve this because the people who know better are reduced to the margins, basically. And so we need to move to a multi, our approach is to move to a multi-party proportional electoral structure. So what this does is it decentralizes political power. And that is one of the goals. And you people can learn more about this at Fair Vote, which is a national organization. They can learn it through Doug Amey's website at Holy Hope College, if they want to learn more about proportional representation. Every democratic system in the world, of the 112 so-called democratic systems, only five do not have proportional representation. That includes the United States, Canada, Britain, Australia, and India. And so what we're looking at is, in a proportional system, your party or candidate gets 10% of the vote, you get 10% of the seats. And this lends itself to engaging people. In every proportional system, you get a 75 to 95% turnout because people go, I can vote more accurately to my values and not have to get a huge number to get a seat at the table. And
so, for instance, in the House of Minnesota Representatives, and I saw this in when I was doing research for the show, I mean, this is a fascinating idea, guys, you know, and please call in 646-929-2495 and weigh in on the discussion. But, you know, what you're saying is, so let's say you have three or four parties running and so-and-so gets 40%, Dayton gets 60, and another guy gets 4%, and you know, somebody else gets 3%. So I don't know how my math worked out there. I'm not a math person. But
let me just
what
clarify.
Would that look like in the House then when you say they
okay.
get a seat?
So just to clarify, for single seat offices, there's different voting methods. We've used what's known as ranked choice voting, or some people know it as instant runoff voting, is applied. That's for single seat offices. For councils and legislatures, you've got proportional representation. So for the House of Minnesota, right now we have a 134-member body in the Minnesota House, okay? And I would like to increase it about 50%, so make it about a 200-member body. We would break out of our single-member districts and go to voting regions. So let's say, hypothetically, we set up similar to, let's say, Sweden, something like that, where you would have maybe out of 200-member body, we would have 20 voting regions. There would be no primary. You go in the booth when you get the biggest turnout, the best indicator of what people feel like. You can go in the booth. You can pick, let's say, in a list system, you pick your favorite party or your favorite person. And in a voting region where 10 members are getting elected out of that region, if your party gets 10% of the vote, you win one seat in the Minnesota House.
Wow.
20%, two seats. 30%, three seats. You can go inside, let's say, a party list, and you want to pick an individual, a person you like. Check them off. They get 10% of the vote. They win the seat in the Minnesota House. So what this does is it basically allows people to vote, like I mentioned before, more accurately with their values and not have to get a huge number to get a seat at the table. And this also shifts power, because right now you've got coalitions formed in the dominant two parties. So in the Republicans, you got the Christian right, and you got the, you know, the corporatists, and you got the conservatives, and you got libertarians, and so on. In the Democrats, mm-hmm. you got labor, peace movement, eco movement, women's movement, corporatists as well. And then what this would do is the way they set up now is they form coalitions outside of decision making. They get in caucuses and they make noise. In this situation, it decentralizes power, so there could be a labor party. There could be an authentic eco party or women's party, or there could be an authentic less government, less taxes party. And then they get the votes that they need, 10%, they win a seat inside the decision-making. Instead of being external to power in a proportional system, you've now moved your power position from outside to inside the committee room.
Hmm. How does this work in the countries where they have this kind of system? I mean, are they more able to be more environmental? I know Sweden, you know, we talked earlier, that was my example because my ex-sister-in-law lives there, so I'm very, I know what's going on as far as their lifestyle and the benefits she received living in a system like that. But how does it pan out?
Well, nothing's perfect. There's no, once again, and we have to talk about money in politics also to clarify this, because the network, we want these three mandates I'm proposing, and I'll mention it again, to happen simultaneously. Nothing's perfect, but nothing comes close to the juggernaut of the United States. The United mm-hmm. States juggernaut is beyond anything human history has ever seen. We are consuming at rates well beyond carrying capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And we are, so in our situation, it's not working, this existing situation is not working well at all. And so what we're looking at is a situation where we need to remedy that. And the people that do want to, you know, like I mentioned, labor earlier, or the people who want less government, less taxes, I mean, they don't buy into this corporate global trade stuff, you know. There's a lot of people who just don't buy into that. And yet
mm-hmm.
the dominant two parties are being, you can't deal with them. You can't even talk about it. It's not even a discussion. I mean, we look at Barack Obama trying to put a stimulus package together for $400 billion after the first one, the second one that came along, and non-discussion. Doesn't even get a discussion, basically, in the House and Senate. Doesn't even get the votes. But you put a package together for South Korea and Panama and Colombia, 83% of the Congress passes it before they even wake up and have coffee in the morning. I mean, it's pathetic. We cannot get an honest assessment of what the culture needs. It's disingenuous. So what you have in Minneapolis and St. Paul, 100% of the Minnesota House and Senate members are Democrats. 100%. Are you telling me there's no Republicans in Minneapolis and St. Paul, no Greens, no Libertarians, no Socialists, no Ecology Democracy Party people? Of course not. We're not getting an honest reflection of the values of the culture, so we cannot refresh the system. We cannot evolve in the existing system. Most House and Senate races, state and national, are decided well in advance. We're talking 90% of the House and Senate races generally are decided in advance because the dominant two parties draw their lines, create safe districts, and they're guaranteed to win. It's not even, you know, basically what they do is they are picking the voters in advance, creating the illusion that voters are picking the candidates. It's a trick.
Well, I know if you don't have a representation there, I mean, I've seen the Minnesota's pretty decent for voter turnout. We're often number one in the nation, but
same day registration.
But that's you know, sad when, you know, half the time there's 20 or 30 or sometimes even 50% of the people don't even turn out to vote.
Right.
You know,
but
so you can talk about high voter turnout, but I mean, when half the people aren't even coming, what does that say about
I think part of it people have been, once again, if you organize in the system, let's say, and we'll go to the money aspect of it, and you've done what you're told to do, grassroots organizing. We organized against nuclear waste storage above ground at Prairie Island, which is a nuclear power plant 45 minutes south of Minneapolis on the Mississippi River. And we did it. We won the democracy. If people say you get out, you mobilize, you go door to door, you talk to your friends, you go to the churches, you go to everybody, you bring them together and they say, we don't want nuclear waste storage above ground on the Mississippi River. It's irrelevant if, for one, XL Energy, at that time Northern States Power, is really running state energy policy. The decision pretty much is made in advance over if you store or don't store nuclear waste above ground. So when people participate in the system, they say huge money, political entrenchment, hindering their ability to translate what the people want, then a lot of people just become discouraged. And they go, I gave it. I mean, I've been doing this for years. I'm giving it everything I got. And the interests that are killing the host, planet Earth, our resource base, win every day. And I have no chance against these companies.
I heard that almost verbatim at our coffee party meeting yesterday. Somebody brought up that point. I do have a caller at 407.
Go for it.
So
yeah,
407, what's your name and where are you calling from? Oh, sorry, go ahead. Are you there? 407, are you there? Would you like to add to the discussion? If you've pressed 1 and you'd like to talk, you're live on the air right now. Well, I don't think they've realized that they're on.
Okay, well, just to transition to the money thing and then I'll stop talking for a while, but I got so much to say, as you can tell. I can go on for days.
These are great ideas, and I just want to throw it out there to the listeners, you know, I mean, go ahead, call in, press 1. I will get to you when it seems like a natural break in the conversation. And 407, if you'd still like to join the discussion, I'll try you again in a moment. If you want to join the conversation, you call in 646-929-2495. Press 1, and you'll be placed in a queue, and then I can bring you into the discussion by calling out your area code. So I'll say 407 or 651 or whatever your area code is. So if you do press 1, please listen for your area code, and that's when you know that I've opened up the lines to you so you can add your ideas. What do you think about this? What do you think about an ecology-based economy where we actually consider the costs of the environment along with the cost of production, the cost of labor, the cost of everything else? What do you think about a more representative democracy with instant voter runoff, with a proportional representation in our houses, in our legislatures? Give us a call. Join the conversation. This is a show dedicated to connecting people, connecting ideas, getting the ideas out there. You know, we have the 1% media, and they are a lot of times just feeding us this information, this lie that we don't matter, that we don't have a place at the table, you know, but we can go buy something today to make us feel better about it. So if you would like to buck that trend and join our 99% media here, the number again is 646-929-2495, and we're with Ken Pentel, and he is just throwing ideas out there, not just throwing them out there. These are ideas that he's been dedicated to for years. He has even been part of creating a new party here in Minnesota. It's the Ecology Democracy Network. And not only did he start a party, he also ran. And I know if you listen to my show before, I tell you, don't just go vote. Go door knock. Go phone call. Get involved. Find your local board meeting and show up. The world is run by those who show up. And I know it feels like if you don't have $1 billion, you can't be part of a campaign. Not true. Even though we have this two-party system in Minnesota, we also had a Jesse Ventura. So, you know, and you know what? It is going to stay this way if we don't do anything. So, anyway, sorry about that, Ken.
No, good, good. And what you're talking about is mobilizing energy to power. I mean, humans who agree with these ideas or generally agree with them. And I'm telling people, and one of the things we did, Jessica, when we started this effort was, you know, okay, so let's people don't like me. They don't like all the ideas or whatever. But we're saying, okay, fine. Then do your work at the grassroots, mobilize all this energy, and start your own political party. And so we developed through the network a party starter kit for Minnesota, the nuts and bolts of how to start your own political party. And,
are you serious?
So we're basically saying if human energy is bubbling up and you are not satisfied with your choices, here's a kit. Start your own political party. I mean, we're trying to push for a multi-party proportional system. And one of the ways to do it is to get people to recognize that they can also develop a political party. Because they can sit around and you know, complain, which I understand. I'm into complaining myself, as people can tell. But basically, okay, now what are you going to do with that energy? What are you going to do with it? You're going to hand it over to the established interests? They count on your apathy. They count on people's apathy, or they count on people's oppression. You know, that's one of the things power counts on.
I understand being busy, and I know what it's like because, like I said, I'm a tool for Target Corporation. I basically make their me and a bunch of other people like me make their corporation, their shareholders, filthy, stinking rich because they make millions of dollars every quarter, hundreds of millions of dollars every quarter, right? And so, but here's the thing, guys. I've got 3 kids that I take care of during the week, one that comes and visits me on the weekends, and I work. Last year, I worked almost every day. I also was a part-time student. I'm also a writer, so I have to have my days where I write or I go nuts. And you know, Ray Bradbury died this past week, and one of his quotes was, you have to keep writing so that reality can't kill you or something like that. He said it much better than me, which is why I was Ray Bradbury. So don't tell me you're too busy, guys, because we're all too busy. And a function of the economy and the structure that we have right now, and I set it down in D.C., is to keep us that way. So that we can't connect together, we can't get together face to face. You know, we have, you know, Facebook now, so that we. I can't believe how many conversations I hear where people are like, "Oh, thank God for Facebook! I actually talk to my friends now." I'm thinking, what? You know, but it's true. I mean, there's so many people I talk to now that I never really conversed with before. But at the same time, we can connect better. And like I opened the show with the idea, with the question, are our minds so steeped in cynicism and conventional wisdom and selfishness that we can't imagine or create the solutions to our problems? I mean, this is our chance to just get rid of that crap that's killing us and killing our earth and really start listening to some of the ideas.
Right. And then remember, there's a lot of people that have learned the system. It's what they're comfortable with. It's how they found their comfort zone in the existing system. And so when you approach them and you say, we need to change things, we need to get private money out of public campaigns, for example, and have public officials publicly funded. Does that make sense to you? You know, and they go, well, it makes sense, but it'll never happen. you know,
right.
Because they basically they don't want to really work to make a change. And part of it is the idea that people have that certain things can't change. Well, that would be like saying the building I'm in right now existed before somebody thought about it. You know, well, that's not the way the mind works. I mean, first somebody had to imagine something, right? They had to, and then they got a piece of paper and a pencil and they started, you know, scratching down a design and, you know, eventually it became a manifested building that physically I'm sitting in right now. And so, you know, that's the way movement's built too. You know, it doesn't happen, you know, you can't build a bridge before you thought about it. You know, it just doesn't work that way. And so we need to transform and liberate ourselves from the bubble we're in. And it's not that everything is bad. There are some beautiful things that are part of the existing system. And there are beautiful people who work for dysfunctional systems. It's not about that. It's about the physical manifestation we're dealing with right now. The evidence, the World Wildlife Fund comes out with a report last week that we're decimating biodiversity on the Earth. Now, these are some of the best scientists in the world. Are we going to say that they're dysfunctional? No. These people spend their days studying this stuff. They are giving us signs. They're giving us indicators. We need to respond to that. And so in the Ecology Democracy Network, now, I'll give you another example about collective energy, Jessica, you just brought up, that people feel like they can't do it or make the change. You know, we're out petitioning the other day to get a candidate on the ballot. And I've been going out every day. I went out on like 11 out of 14 days door knocking with two other people who were out about the same time for me. And we were really just getting a little bit at a time. You know, it's very tedious work to get signatures, to get somebody on the ballot. And then one day we had like six people show up. And in about 3 hours, those six people collected more signatures than our three people did in like 2 days.
Wow.
So people are busy, but if you can create a group, let's say five, six people who are tight and focused and mobilized, then you can share the work and you don't have to spend as much time to achieve the outcome. It doesn't take a lot of people to make change. It just takes a small group of committed people, Margaret Mead, to really transform the world. And so people shouldn't think they have to have 100% support for change. It doesn't take 100% of the people. It takes a small, committed group of people first. Then you build from there. And that's how you make the change we're looking for. And obviously, we touched on the money and politics situation. It's well known now. It's so grotesque. And most people know about it. And those movements are growing to try to get money out of politics. And that's one of the other things that the network supports. So our network focus is, you know, structural change in the economy, the way we vote, and who influences our government. That's our focus. We're not going to chase symptoms to problems. You know, a lot of times, you know, the eco movement I worked in for the last 30 years, they were a lot of it was just consumer-based problem solving. So take a bag to the store, ride your bike, you know, plant a garden. I mean, I'm not against any of that. It's all good. There's models out there. There's examples that we need to enhance, the healers, the people that are doing the right things. We want to buff them up. But if we're serious about achieving a proportionate response to the problem or a commensurate response, then we have to have a system that is measured to achieve it. You can't have a consumer-based approach because once you've had dysfunctional design, engineering, and manufacturing, and the genie's out of the bottle, consumers are never, ever, ever going to get it back in the bottle. We may get a few crumbs, and there may be a few examples of success here or there, but proportionately, it's irrelevant. It's like low-flow showerheads. Well, 90% of the fresh water is used by industry and agriculture in the society. You could get 100% of the consumers in homes using low-flow showerheads, and it will not even show up on the radar. I mean, the big water use is going to cows and going to, you know, power plants and chemical facilities, you know, that use it at pretty much freebie at this point, and contaminate it, and then dump it back into our water, and then have us pay the price in, you know, health deficiencies in some way, you know, some sort of cancer or something.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, look at all the amount of water it takes to to get extract the oil out of the tar sands just north
there
of here where most of our gas comes from,
exactly.
Where we've destroyed the indigenous people's home and food supply and,
right.
and entire culture
exactly.
so that
so,
I can drive to work every day. I-407, I'm going to go to you once again. If you would like to join our discussion here with Ken Pentel, please tell us your name.
When I threw it out, but he said it had moisture in it.
Okay, well, I don't think that they realize they're on the air. So anyway, back to discussion. We do have 5 minutes left, so if
okay.
somebody does want to call in, you'll have to keep your question
please.
Really brief. But
call in.
I encourage you to call in. I encourage people to also visit the website. And can you give us the website for the Ecology Democracy Network?
That is it, www.ecologydemocracynetwork.org. EcologyDemocracyNetwork.org is the website. And so people can go to that. They can Google Ken Pentel. They'll find me there. So one way or the other, you'll track me down.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But
and
many ideas, you guys.
Yeah.
We barely
and
got to
I
cover
to say
any
this,
of them.
I know we got so many. One thing I did want to mention was the problems and solutions to what we're talking about have been dealt with decades ago. You know,
mm-hmm.
we know how to live in balance with the earth. That's not, we don't need to invent anything new to tell us that. What we do need to do is how do we build our collective will for transformation? That's the test. How do you build energy to outcomes? And that is really the test. And how do we raise our expectations to the level that we're not going to tolerate British Petroleum, BP, walking away without being jailed for their crimes in the Gulf of Mexico? How do we raise
right.
our expectations where we jail the top 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 people in the financial industry for committing the greatest bank heist in human history? You know, how
mm-hmm.
do we deal with these interests that have done massive damage through fracking and through mountaintop removal and through species extinction? How do we raise our expectations where we no longer tolerate those interests interfering in our governance
mm-hmm.
and allowing them to contaminate our public airwaves with their commercialization? We're serious about repairing our relationship to the host. We're going to have to deal with people on Earth who do this stuff every day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
mm-hmm.
where people in the movements I've been involved with are squeamish. They get scared. They don't like hearing the word power. Well, we're going to have to overcome that, folks, because if you're serious about this change, you know, and I challenge the Chinese government. I challenge the Russian government. I challenge people all over the world that say, we care about our heritage. We care about our children. You know, okay, China, you claim you care about all that. Then you would have hunted down and caged the CEO and the board of directors of ExxonMobil for putting genetic history of the earth at risk and using up
That's
the resources
right.
that your kids need, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that, no, we just seemingly are waiting for something else to, you know, strike us. But we haven't come to terms with the issues of those issues of accountability. It just, we don't,
mm-hmm.
we seemingly can't do it right now. No one can do it.
Well,
I mean, no one on earth can
do it. That's the social justice aspect of it for me. I mean, if we can, you know, jail, you know, how many of a percentage of our African American men and women in this country,
yeah.
and create an entire industry to, you know, to manipulate and profit from that, and then
exactly.
turn around and create laws so that we have to pile them as full as possible and as make as much money off of it. I mean, do you guys realize that if we went back to the laws of 1970s, we'd have to let go of 4 out of the 5 prisoners that are in jail right now? And was it really
go.
So bad in the 70s? Was crime really so bad in the 70s that we, you know, can't even consider that? And you know, if we can P-test struggling single moms who are tools of the Targets and the Walmarts and everything else in this country, all these big corporations that hire us for minimum wage and don't give us benefits and don't even think about giving us full-time work, then I think if we can P-test all those people who are reaching out for a hand up, then I think we can maybe use our judicial system to have justice in this country, to put behind bars some of those people who killed 11 people in the Gulf of Mexico, 11 men, and who destroyed the mom-and-pop industries that survived on that ecology, on getting people
yeah.
out, on getting
yeah.
people involved in their environment and having that family time.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what we're talking about here today on The Bottom Line. And we, I could just, oh gosh, I could talk to you forever.
I know. It's great.
It's been
stuff,
really
great.
Stuff.
Oh, I love it.
Right.
No, I mean, you need to keep this discussion going. And one thing I wanted to mention, Jessica, if you and your crew are interested in having a sit down and viewing a video by Marilyn Waring called Sex, Lies, and Global Economics. Highly recommended. I have it with me, so call me and we can view it and have a discussion about it because I think it encompasses a lot of what you and I just talked about. She's a brilliant woman from New Zealand, Marilyn Waring. And
Excellent. Well, that's the education
so.
Part. We've
yeah.
got to educate. We've got to organize. We've got to mobilize, guys, because really seriously, our generation, we know what's coming down the pike. Well, thanks so much, Ken. You've been amazing, and I knew it was going to be a great couple hours, but it went by way too fast. I hope you'll think about coming on again.
Oh, for sure. I'd love to.
Awesome. Well, have a great rest
thanks
of your
so much
evening.
For doing it.
Stay cool.
You got
Thank
it. Take
you.
Care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye. Well, guys, and again, it was another just really interesting 2 hours, and I thank everyone who called in and who listened into the show. You can catch it on podcast and on archived, not podcast, archives, by going to our website, blogtalkradio.com/coffeepartyusa or /coffeepartyusa. And you know what? Maybe share it with some people. Educating citizens is a huge part of the job that we have in front of us. It's going to take more than a handful of people here in the end to really create change. I mean, we start with a handful of people and we can make a difference. We can do what our ancestors and our parents did, you know, go from societies where women like me were chattel to a society where I can have an education and work like I do and also have the show and talk about these ideas. So, you know, it's not impossible, and it's been a great 2 hours. Also, please check out the Scoop It page. There's going to be information coming out on that this week, scoop.it/the-bottom-line. You can also go to that page and find out more about Ken Pentel. I've posted some videos and some radio interviews there. If you'd like to find out more about his ideas, we hardly even touched the surface. And if you would like to join in this 99% media, just email me, jsnowshine@gmail.com. That's my personal email address, jsnowshine@gmail.com. And let me know if you're interested. I need radio collaborators. I need people who want to find articles to put up on the Scoop It page. I need people who will write original articles themselves, informing us about different actions that are taking place in their community, thoughts like we were discussing today, the impact of this economy that we have on our lives. Those are the kind of things that we want to hear about and put on the Scoop It page. And so if you're interested in that, please do email me, send me a line. And I'd love to continue the discussion next week. I hope you'll join me on The Bottom Line with Jessica English. Have a great night. Bye-bye.